A warning before we start. This podcast does discuss the topic of child abuse and neglect. There will also be strong language.
Before they moved in, the neighbor said, hey, there's supposed to be a family moving in here with like maybe five kids or something. And so we were like going, oh, great. You know, this house has had nothing for, I bet you, 10, 12 years. Drug users, drug dealers, and thieves. So we thought, here we go.
That's Mimi Shuttleworth. She's a Gloucester native who lives two doors down from the house Teresa Fogle moved into on May 24th, 2022. The house where Teresa's fateful encounter with caseworker Jason Lemagaki would take place 1 month later.
Needless to say, with all of that and the previous people that's lived there dealing, using, we kept an eye on it. And I think that Teresa and Tyler had no idea that they were going to be underneath a microscope with all of the neighbors, because that's what we were expecting to see. And the more we watched it on a day-to-day basis, the more we're saying, man, it's, you know, there's two older kids and two younger kids, so maybe there's different fathers here, but is he the father of these two younger kids? Because you would have never known he wasn't. If the girls were outside, he was outside. If their shoes come untied, he'd tie them and say, I'll fix this for you so it won't come untied again. I mean, we were all like going, he's a genuine father image if he's not the father. Always cooked meals. She would cook outside, or they'd bring plates out. They'd sit on the trampoline, the kids. They would eat. Every single evening, I even made a comment to the neighbor. I said, do you notice you never, ever see children in little pajamas with their hair wet and stuff at bedtime? They come out, you know, after they got out of the tub, and they're eating their, you know, bedtime snack or whatever they'd have in their hand. So you knew she got them bathed, hair washed, pajamas on, and ready for bed, and they were eating a snack before they went to bed. I mean, we were utterly amazed that this is a decent family that we got in here for a change.
Mimi's words stand in sharp contrast to what Children's Services would allege about Teresa's family in court on June 27th.
And then when all this went down, we were all looking at each other, how could that happen? What happened here? What did we miss? You know? And we don't think we missed anything. We all believe that Children's Services failed to do their job.
From WOUB News, this is episode 3 of 150 Days. I'm Teo Peck Suzuki.
And I'm David Forster.
This question, what did we miss, is one David and I spent a lot of time asking one another. And the more we looked into Teresa's case, the harder it became to imagine what magical strand of evidence could suddenly make what Children's Services did make sense.
Thank you. We're on record. Today's date is the 27th day of June, 2022. We're in the Juvenile Division of Athens County Court of Common Pleas in Athens County, Ohio, here for a hearing on the agency's motion to continue the emergency custody order that was granted this weekend on Saturday, June 25th.
That's Athens County Juvenile Court Judge Zach Saunders at the start of Teresa's shelter care hearing where, as the judge noted, Children's Services is seeking to continue its emergency custody of her children.
It's been a while, so let's quickly recap where we are in the story. On May 24th, 2022, Teresa moves to Gloucester, Ohio. There are five people with her. Her two teenage sons, Josiah and Azriel, her two younger daughters, Ryland and Everly, and her boyfriend Tyler, who isn't related to any of Teresa's kids. 1 month later, on June 25th, Teresa and Josiah have a big argument. Josiah and Azriel go to the library, where they meet a caseworker from Athens County Children's Services and make some pretty serious allegations. The caseworker briefly confronts Teresa at her house. Teresa drives off. The caseworker petitions the juvenile court judge to remove all four of Teresa's children. The judge grants the request. Now it's 2 days later, June 27th. Teresa has her first court date.
Today is really twofold. One, I have to determine whether there is probable cause for the initial issuance of the ex parte order that occurred this past Saturday, and two, whether there's probable cause for the shelter care or emergency custody of the agency to continue.
The first thing Teresa notices is that she doesn't have a lawyer.
So it sounds like what Jason said to you was you're going to have an attorney appointed to you.
Jason Lemagaki is the caseworker who removed Teresa's children.
So you presumed, okay, well, if you say I'm going to have an attorney appointed to me, then for this court hearing that I'm about to go into, I assume my attorney that I'm going to get is going to be there.
That's what I thought.
But no one actually said explicitly,
no,
we're going to get you an attorney for this exact hearing. And
no.
Okay.
No. I mean, I was just assuming because we were going to court, I would have an attorney.
Teresa shows up to court an hour early to fill out the paperwork showing she can't afford her own lawyer and needs one appointed to her. She's expecting to have an attorney at the hearing. It turns out she doesn't.
I do want to let the parents know that you do have the right to counsel in this case, meaning you have the right to an attorney. An attorney will be appointed for you if you are eligible.
That's Judge Saunders again. Teresa not only has a right to an attorney, but she has the right to have an attorney at this hearing. But that's not going to happen. So Teresa is told she has a right to an attorney, but also that she won't get one until after the hearing. We'll explain why that is in a little bit. Meanwhile, the judge tells Teresa she'll have a chance to speak during the hearing, but he doesn't recommend it.
Anything that you say can be used against you. If you wish to consult with an attorney first, before making a statement, I would recommend or urge that you speak with the counsel once that counsel is appointed before making a statement.
Teresa takes the judge's advice.
And I was like, I'm not saying anything until I have an attorney. And then I shut my mouth. Yeah. I wasn't saying nothing.
Now, Children's Services does have a lawyer, an assistant prosecutor named Brittany Leach. Leach calls just one witness.
I would like to call Ms. Jaislyn McGackie.
This is the caseworker. In court, Leach asks Jaislyn what she did to investigate the boys' allegations.
I went to the library in Gloucester where they were and spoke with the children. Josiah had a video that he showed me of the incident where he was knocking on the window with a hammer, and then where Mr. Tingley then approached him. In the video, you could see Mr. Tingley like lunge forward at Josiah, but you can't see a hammer in his hand because the video cuts off right when that begins, and you can hear Teresa yell at him to stop right as the video is about to end. And upon speaking with both Josiah and Asriel and Mr. Tingley, they all confirmed that he did have a hammer in his hand at the time of this incident. In speaking with Josiah and Asriel, they also stated that Teresa has asked Josiah to get her marijuana in the past from his friends, and he has refused to do so, he has said. And they also stated that there isn't food in the home and that they are being evicted from the residence, even though they had just moved to the area in May.
Children's Services says these allegations are what justified taking Teresa's kids from her. They're basically saying, look, these kids were not safe in this home. We had to take them. Here's why.
We'll dig into those allegations in a little bit. For now, the point is, Teresa is seething. She's thinking, I've got evidence to contradict a lot of what the caseworker is saying, but I can't present any of it because I don't have a lawyer.
What Teresa doesn't realize is, this is just how these shelter care hearings work. They're the first of many hearings in the child welfare process, and they're not actually about proving the allegations. Shelter care hearings are about demonstrating what's called probable cause.
Probable cause is a very low standard of proof. It's what police have to show to get a search warrant. The idea being, there will be a full hearing on the allegations later, but for now, it's an emergency, and we just need to get the kids somewhere safe.
Some critics say it's dangerous to allow child removal based on such a low standard, but that's how the system works.
On top of that, the rules of evidence are relaxed at a shelter care hearing. Under normal circumstances, you're not allowed to bring what's called hearsay into court. This is something someone said outside of court that one side is trying to use as evidence. Basically, everything Jaislyn says on the stand is hearsay because she's repeating what Teresa's boys told her. Under the rules of evidence, the boys would be called into court and asked what they told the caseworker. This way, the court is hearing it straight from the boys, who would be under oath. But when the rules of evidence are relaxed, hearsay becomes admissible, meaning Children's Services doesn't need to back up anything its caseworker says with other evidence.
So the scales are tipped pretty favorably towards the agency at this first hearing, and that's not even considering the fact that most parents, including Teresa, don't have a lawyer yet.
Athens County Juvenile Court Judge Zach Saunders estimates around 97% of parents in his courtroom are too poor to afford their own counsel. That means they have to rely on a court-appointed attorney. And because the shelter care hearing must take place within 72 hours of the removal and often happens within 24 hours, the time frame becomes an issue.
If it weren't an emergency hearing, then of course I would push it out to allow them to counsel to have that hearing. I don't have the luxury though.
Saunders says the court simply cannot appoint an attorney in 72 hours, especially in a rural county like Athens with only a handful of attorneys who will take on this kind of work.
While we're in this hearing, we're calling to try to get an attorney. I have attorneys that are from Lancaster, from Columbus.
Lancaster is more than one county away. Columbus is even farther.
So it's impossible for me to have someone here within that time frame, which is unfortunate, because if I could have a full-time attorney here, I would take it in a heartbeat.
Now, we did talk to some lawyers who do work shelter care hearings, mostly public defenders in the few Ohio counties where public defenders handle these cases. Unlike court-appointed lawyers, public defenders are right there in the courthouse, ready to meet new clients as soon as they walk in. So all those issues Saunders laid out a moment ago with finding attorneys, that doesn't apply to the very small handful of Ohio counties that have juvenile court public defenders.
The public defenders we spoke to say they very rarely win outright at shelter care hearings because probable cause is such a low standard for the Children's Services Agency to meet. But they can still have an impact in some cases.
I sometimes convince the magistrate that they didn't do an investigation and the kids are returned with protective supervision.
This is Denise Ferguson, a public defender in Cuyahoga County.
And sometimes I just go to the prosecutor and say, seriously, we can either fight this out or you can give 24 hours and go back out and look at it again. And sometimes that 24 hours, if we get that, not only does the agency go back out and look, but that gives me time to bring other people in that could help prove the fact that there's no issue with these kids at a probable cause hearing.
We also talked last episode about something called reasonable efforts. That's where agencies are supposed to try to find alternatives to removal before separating children from their parents. If a lawyer like Denise Ferguson thinks the agency didn't make reasonable efforts, they can challenge that at the shelter care hearing and potentially convince the agency to go back out and do a more thorough investigation.
None of that happens for Teresa, though, because again, she doesn't have an attorney yet, so the judge fines for the agency. The case will proceed. Children's Services will have temporary custody of Teresa's kids for at least another month. Now, the agency isn't fully in the clear yet. Once that month is up, there will be another hearing, the adjudication. And if they lose there, the case is over. Kids go home.
At the adjudication, Children's Services may actually have to prove in court that the allegations against Teresa are true. No more probable cause then. They're facing a much higher standard called clear and convincing. On top of that, Teresa will have a lawyer. And that means Children's Services has to spend the next month building a case, collecting evidence, preparing for what is essentially a trial.
Except there's a bit of a problem, one that I think will become clear as we go through the evidence David and I were able to find when we investigated the allegations ourselves. Let's start with a piece that supposedly ties everything together, the video of Josiah and Tyler.
I'm going to read from Jaselyn's sworn affidavit. This is a written document submitted to the court the same day as the shelter care hearing. Quote, at one point, Mr. Tingley, that's Tyler, swung a hammer at JF, that's Josiah. The other children were present during the incident. This was caught on video and posted to a social media website by mother. Now, let's listen again to Jaselyn's spoken testimony at the shelter care hearing.
In the video, you can see Mr. Tingley, like, lunge forward at Josiah, but you can't see a hammer in his hand because the video cuts off right when that begins. And you can hear Teresa yell at him to stop right as the video is about to end.
You may notice there is a difference between Jaselyn's written affidavit and Jaselyn's spoken testimony. The affidavit says Tyler swung a hammer and that this was caught on video. But in Jaselyn's testimony,
you can't see a hammer in his hand because the video cuts off.
So why is this such a big deal? Well, because if you look at the affidavit, This video evidence of Tyler attacking Josiah is the only hard evidence showing that Teresa's home is violent. Future documents from Teresa's case go on to reference this same video. But if the video doesn't really show Tyler swinging a hammer, then what evidence is there?
David and I didn't get a hold of Jaclyn's spoken testimony for a long time. During the early months of our investigation, we just had the affidavit, and we couldn't wrap our heads around why Jaclyn was claiming, in writing, that there was this video of Tyler swinging a hammer at Josiah. Because Teresa showed us the video, and we didn't even see a hammer in Tyler's hand, much less anything to suggest he attacked Josiah with it.
The only person we see in the video with a hammer is Josiah.
Go turn my damn phone back on right now. Go turn my phone on right now.
That's Josiah standing outside the window of his mom's car. He's upset because she's canceled his cell phone service.
That is illegal.
No, it's not.
Yes, the fuck.
I pay the bill. No, it's not.
Teresa is recording from the driver's seat. The camera is pointed toward the passenger window. For the first 45 seconds of the video, which is 47 seconds long, the only person we see is Josiah. Josiah has a hammer. He hits the car window with the hammer.
Not playing with you, Teresa.
Shortly after, Tyler enters the frame from the left. Both his arms are pointed down and remain that way. His hands are not visible. Tyler takes a step toward Josiah, but there is still clearly space between the two. Josiah takes a couple steps back. Tyler then also steps back. At no point does the video show Tyler touching or lunging toward Josiah. Then the video ends.
Hey!
David and I tossed around all kinds of theories trying to explain this discrepancy between the affidavit and the video. David went through the video frame by frame, double-checking, triple-checking, quadruple-checking, looking for some indication of Tyler even winding up to attack Josiah.
Teresa freely admitted that she posted the video on social media, but she maintained from the beginning that it didn't show what McGackie's affidavit claimed.
I would have never posted a video of anybody trying to attack my child. I'm not an idiot. Nobody tried to harm my son.
But just to be safe, we asked ourselves, let's say she's lying and that she did post a video of Tyler attacking Josiah. In that case, she must have edited it later. So when did she have that opportunity?
Teresa showed the video to her neighbor, Sue McGee, and the sheriff's deputies at around 2 p.m. on June 25th, the day of the removal. Sue McGee says the video did not show Tyler swinging a hammer. So if Teresa did edit the video, it would have to have been before she went to Sue's house, but after Jaclyn got to the library, which was sometime after noon. That is not a very big window. It's not impossible, but it's tricky. Also, if she did edit the video, she did it in a very odd way. She could have cut Tyler out entirely, just edited him out of the whole situation. But she didn't.
And in the last few frames, it does not look like Tyler is about to swing a hammer. He and Josiah are in the process of moving apart as the video ends. Also, for what it's worth, the video has a timestamp, 9:39 a.m. on June 25th, 2022. That's the day and time the original incident took place.
All this to say, David and I were pretty sure the video did not show what Jaclyn's affidavit claimed. But we had this nagging doubt because how could that be? What if we missed something?
Then we finally heard Jaclyn's spoken testimony. And, to our surprise, Jaclyn acknowledged on the witness stand that there was no hammer visible in Tyler's hand. That, in fact, we never see Tyler swing a hammer at anyone. Which is exactly what Teo and I had also found.
And this brings us back to Teresa's lack of a lawyer. Because if Teresa had a competent defense attorney, that attorney could have cross-examined Jaclyn and said, hey, wait a sec. What do you mean the video doesn't show Tyler swinging a hammer? You said in your affidavit that it did. How do you even know Tyler had a hammer if it's not in the video? That kind of thing. But Teresa doesn't have an attorney, so this glaring discrepancy between Jaclyn's affidavit and her written testimony never gets questioned.
We're harping on about this video because of all the allegations against Teresa, this is the only one that seemed to us like it really came close to the standard of harm that supposedly warrants removing children. And if the allegation isn't true, or if there's no evidence to support it, then it raises the question, what was the justification for removing the children? What was the point of any of this?
The video wasn't the only allegation against Teresa, though. Next on our list, we have a couple we'll lump together. The family was at risk of losing their home, had a history of being homeless, and the family had no food.
If you listen to the first two episodes, the issues here should leap out at you pretty quickly. First of all, we have a history of Teresa's living situation stretching back more than a decade. There are government records and school records confirming her address. We also know that Butler County Children's Services approved her as a permanent kinship placement for her nephew Dylan, something that's hard to imagine them doing if they were concerned about homelessness. We even spoke with Teresa's ex-boyfriend, Justin, someone who is not on the best terms with Teresa, and he backed her up.
No, never. Never homeless. From the moment we got together, we had an apartment together. I moved out of my townhouse and moved into an apartment in Trenton. And then from there, we rented a house for like 8 years, and then our landlord was losing his house, so we had to find a place to go. So I bought a house in Middletown, and we've been there, ever since.
Now, it is true that Teresa was facing a potential eviction on June 25th because she couldn't afford to pay the rent. But she'd already taken steps to stave that off. She'd contacted a legal aid attorney and was in the process of getting rent assistance from a local community action group. And even if she hadn't gotten the rent assistance, it's within Children's Services' mandate to help families with housing issues, but they didn't.
When we talked to Justin, he also backed Teresa up on the food allegation. Now, Justin can only speak to Teresa's situation before she moved to Gloucester. So you might be thinking, well, maybe that's when they ran out of food. Except, they didn't.
Teresa shared with us the account detailing her food assistance benefits since her move to Gloucester. Those benefits can only be spent on food, and they showed she had received her benefits, nearly $1,000 a month, and spent them. Teresa also showed us photos she took of her pantry on May 26th, the day after she arrived in Gloucester, and June 27th, the morning before her shelter care hearing. In both cases, the pantry is full of food. Also, remember Sue McGee and her son Xavier? Xavier is the boy who became close friends with Teresa's older daughter Rylan.
I just have one more question that I'd like to ask before we wrap this up, and that's going back to something you said. You said Xavier used to go to their house for dinner.
Yeah, she would be at our house. We're the neighborhood hangout. So the boys from the down the street would come up, and Matthew, Chris, and Alex were always at our house. And if they were, it was always at dinner time. The kids were all at our house at dinner time. You could see the bikes out in the driveway. If they're at our house, they ate at our house.
But he would also go to...
But he would go down there, and he would either eat at their house, or one night they went to the lake, and they grilled out steaks at the lake. And then they also went to Hocking Hills, and they had either made dinner or stopped and picked up dinner on the way home.
At this point in our interview, we hadn't said anything about lack of food being an allegation against Teresa. McGee just happened to mention that Xavier used to eat dinner at Ryland's house. And I thought, well, that's odd. That doesn't sound like something that would happen at a house where there's no food.
As with the video, we still spent a significant amount of time asking ourselves what we could have missed. But as with the video, there was no evidence to support this allegation in the discovery. And again, that's important because if it's not in the discovery, it's not going to be used at the adjudication trial. It can't be.
Oh, and if you remember Mimi Shuttleworth from the start of the episode, another of Teresa's neighbors, she also backs up Sue McGee's story.
She'd have food. I saw him one night get out of the car right after dark because, like I said, they had no idea we were constantly watching out the windows. And they must have carried 12 bags of food in, and they were Kroger bags because they were brown. I knew they came from Kroger's. So I knew, they were getting fed.
So we've just spent quite a while talking about whether the allegations against Teresa are true. And that's because we figure, well, you probably want to know whether they're true or not. I mean, we did. But a lot of people say that's actually the wrong question.
even if every one of the allegations you have mentioned were true, it wouldn't be grounds to remove.
This is Richard Wexler, founder and director of the National Coalition for Child Protection Reform.
Lack of food is grounds to call a food bank. Lack of housing is grounds for a rent subsidy. And if a boyfriend is swinging around a hammer and engaging in assault, that's grounds to remove the boyfriend from the home. There is a method for that. It's called arrest, and there is a placement available. It's called jail.
Remember from the last episode, child removal is extremely traumatic. And so there is this idea that removal should be the last resort. That's even how people in the system frame it. But Wexler is arguing, look, in reality, agencies don't remove when it's a last resort. They remove because that's what the system incentivizes them to do.
That's something we talked about in the last episode, but we're bringing it up again here because it leads to something else critics say often shows up in child welfare cases. A tendency they say agencies have to target people for being poor. You may recall that Judge Saunders said 97% of the parents in his courtroom can't afford attorneys. Critics say that's not just a coincidence.
Children's Services often conflates poverty with neglect and dependency.
That's Kelly Jellinger. She's a public defender who works in Erie County.
Being poor does not make you dependent. Being poor does not make you a neglectful parent. It makes you poor. Doesn't mean that you're a crappy parent. It just means that you're poor. But Children's Services and courts have long held, well, we have to step in and care for these babies. We have to step in and care for these children. They can't do it. They deserve to be where they can be taken care of.
Jellinger is using the word dependency a lot. When we started reporting this story, we didn't understand what that word meant. It's often mentioned in the same breath as abuse and neglect, but it's not clear to a layperson what it actually entails. As it turns out, though, it is a key part of why these cases often go the way they do.
We're going to talk more about dependency in a later episode. For now, dependency is also something agencies can remove children for, like abuse and neglect. But the definition of dependency is very broad. Agencies can say that things like food and housing insecurity are dependencies, even when technically they may just be symptoms of poverty. That's an important distinction.
A family being homeless and not able to provide food for their children is something that happens over time. It's not someone was chasing me with a gun. And so that's an emergency.
That's Matt Starkey, the public information officer for Athens County Children's Services.
Some people just need a little extra help. Rather than saying, find a home or else we're taking your kids, we'll say, we can develop a safety plan with you. We say, hey, we can connect you with services to get you housing. We can connect you with services to get you food. In that instance, a lot of the times, the children can stay with the parents, it's or mother or whomever, you know, because, you know, we go out and see she loves her kids. She's taking care of them the best she can.
Everything Starkey is saying sounds great, but it didn't happen in Teresa's case. She says no one ever talked to her about food or housing assistance.
Also, while Children's Services agencies have policies about helping families deal with poverty, it's very easy for them to opt for removals instead. As we discussed in the previous episode, there may also be significant pressures on caseworkers to go the removal route, and this broad legal term, dependency, gives them a way to do it.
The remaining allegations against Teresa either lack support or else don't seem to meet the level of danger that warrants child removal. Remember that under state law, removal is an option only when there is an imminent threat of serious harm. One of the allegations is that Teresa asked her older son, Josiah, to get marijuana for her. Teresa denies this, and there's no evidence to support it in the discovery. Another is that Teresa had a history with Children's Services in Butler and Warren counties. Teresa does have a history with both of those counties because she took in her nephew Dylan and her half-sister Demi. Also, there was that fight between Azriel and Josiah, and the incident where Josiah slammed the door on Teresa's foot. Both of those are part of her Children's Services file. At the shelter care hearing, the caseworker was asked about Teresa's history with Children's Services. She offered few details, and no details were provided in the discovery, so it's unclear how any past cases placed the children in present danger.
The one allegation Teresa doesn't entirely dispute is that Tyler drove without a license while the children were in the car. She acknowledges that he drove part of the way home from Butler County the morning of June 25th after picking her boys up from her sister's house, but she says he only spent a few minutes behind the wheel and wasn't driving erratically. And that's it. That's all the evidence we turned up for the allegations Children's Services filed against Teresa in court.
Teo and I started working on the story shortly before Teresa's adjudication was set to take place. Both of us were very curious to see how the agency would prove its case, given that we really struggled to substantiate almost all of their claims. In fact, most of the evidence we found seemed to point the other way, that the allegations were largely untrue. We also found no evidence that the agency conducted much, if any, investigation into the allegations before or after the children were removed. Teresa and Tyler said no one from Children's Services ever questioned them about the allegations, which would be an obvious starting point for any investigation.
I was like, you can come into my house. Everybody can come over to my house right now. Like, she wouldn't even let us go.
Sit right in front of Jason.
Yes, to everyone standing there. They were welcome to walk on in. We don't have anything to hide from anyone. I mean, you saw the messages probably where I'm like, I've asked for you to come over to my house to look at this stuff, to look at these things. Why are you not coming to my house? I asked her for 2 weeks to come to my house. I asked her the day of court to come to my house so that they could come in and see there's no food in my house. Who are you to say there's no food in my house when you haven't seen that there's no food in my house?
Right.
Who are you to say that there's guns in my house when you didn't come in here and look for guns in my house? Who are you to say any of these things if you didn't come and look for yourself? We didn't object to anybody. We told them to come to our house, and they did not.
It's now the afternoon of June 27th. The shelter care hearing is over. Teresa is going to spend the next month at least without her children. And Children's Services hasn't had to prove anything. It hasn't had to show any evidence beyond repeating what the boys told the caseworker at the library. But Teresa's about to have a much more pressing problem than lawyers and court hearings.
Having won the shelter care hearing, Children's Services takes Teresa's children to their new placements. Josiah and Azriel, Teresa's teenage sons, go to the house of their Aunt Jamie. That's where Josiah went to stay for most of June, and where he wanted to return after Teresa came to pick him up on the night of June 24th. Teresa's daughters, Rylan and Everly, don't go to Jamie's. They go instead to a foster home in Muskingum County.
Critics have raised many issues with the American foster care system. Rylan and Everly's experience is going to give us a window into why. That's next time on 150 Days. Days is a production of WOUB Public Media. The podcast was written and produced by Teo Peck Suzuki and David Forster. Adam Rich is the audio engineer. Music by Caitlin Krause and Brad Swinarski. To read the digital version of this story, go to wouB.org/150-days.